You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey folks, today's episode is brought to you by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publisher of Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation, the new book by Ann Helen Peterson. Esquire magazine calls Can't Even, quote, a razor-sharp book of cultural criticism. With blistering prose and all-too-vivid reporting, Peterson lays bare the burnout and despair of millennials while also charting a path to a world where members of her generation can feel as if the boot has been removed from their necks. Can't Even by Ann Helen Peterson, available now from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Hey everybody, how you doing? Welcome to the Other People program. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. It's nice to be with you. I hope you're okay wherever you are. I have Laura Bogart on the program today. She has a debut novel out on DeZank Books. It is called Don't You Know I Love You. Laura Bogart is also a nonfiction writer. She publishes personal essays, writing on pop culture, film and television, feminism, body image and sizeism, politics. She writes about a wide range of things. Perhaps you've read her online. She's a featured contributor to The Week, as well as Dame Magazine, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Guardian, Spin, The AV Club, Vulture, and IndieWire. I should mention, too, that I first got to know Laura Bogart as a writer via The Nervous Breakdown. Back when I was editing the site, she published several essays over at The Nervous Breakdown. That was my first experience reading her, and I'm very pleased to see her having this publication success with her novel, which once again is called Don't You Know I Love You. So let's get to it. My conversation with Laura Bogart, talking about her book, her writing, her life, all of it, right now. Here she is, folks. This is Laura Bogart, and her novel, one more time, is called Don't You Know I Love You.
The novel is sort of something that had been percolating in the back of my mind for a long time, but I didn't know, you know, if I could do a novel. I had only done sort of shorter form pieces, and I had a lot of really like intense emotionality and really intense thoughts and feelings around the subject matter of the novel. And it's about like a young woman who is surviving sort of a chaotic, abusive home and coming into herself as an artist, as a woman, and trying to sort of define herself against her family of origin. And I, you know, it's personal to me. That's no secret. And I started out sort of writing them, you know, writing about these feelings in essays and finding context for them in pop culture, and just sort of pouring things out very personally. I tend to be sort of a very interior, intuitive writer and thinker. Like I have to kind of write and process and process and process. And then when I'm sort of ready to do it, then I'm really ready to do it. And which is not to say that the novel did not have its fair share of drafts, because it did. But I definitely was grateful for the platform I had at Nervous Breakdown to just start playing with these ideas and to learn that people actually cared about it.
Well, yeah, no, it's interesting. As I was prepping and rereading some of the essays you published on the Nervous Breakdown years ago, I was thinking that the site functions as a kind of way station. It's almost like a public bulletin board, but it's also like a way station from which I feel like a lot of writers have been able to make an ascent, you know? Yeah. I hope I'm using that metaphor properly. You know, or like
a,
what's the mountaineering term, you know, where there's like a base camp or something from which you sort of make some community, get your work out there, find some readers, and then you have moved on to like bigger online publications and I guess print publications, and then the publication of a novel. But I don't know. I like that conception of it. That seems to be how it's functioned over the years, you know, for people at various stages of their careers.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think honestly the best part of it was the community and was how generous people were and they've been. And I've sort of been very lucky, and I felt a lot of, you know, just love from the literary community, you know, starting to publish back then, publish those essays because they were very raw. And I was really scared to put them out there, you know, where people are going to care. I think culturally speaking, at least at the time when I was publishing them, I think it's changed a little bit now. But, you know, there was this sort of, I guess you might say, like a backlash against the confessional essay. It was this idea of, you know, why does this matter? Is this like a real problem? This isn't something that you're talking about on a global scale. It's sort of the intimacy of your life. And to have people come out and say, you know, hey, this mattered. I was moved by this. I appreciated it. It made me feel like I had something to say. And so I think that the value of community can't really be understated. And then even publishing a novel in a pandemic, you know, I remember, like, you know, this came out in March, and I remember thinking, like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, I can't go to any of the places that I was going to go to. And I have a number of friends that were publishing books around this time. Some of us, it was our first book, and then some of us, it was maybe a second book or a third book. And I felt very supported by literary community. I, you know, there were people immediately coming out and saying, hey, I'm hosting a Zoom reading series, or I'm interviewing writers who've been impacted by this pandemic. You know, I'm excerpting, I'm doing everything. So the support of this community has just made such a difference to me, just not only in the beginning of my career, but just, you know, even in the terms of publishing this book, it's made something that could have been, you know, sort of a sense of a dream kind of withering on the vine a little bit. And I say that in context of knowing that publishing a book in this time and dealing with, you know, things not going off the way that I would have necessarily dreamed that they would is a drop in the bucket compared to what other people are going through. But just having the support of a community like that, it just made it, you know, it really gave things like a silver lining. And made me feel even more connected to something.
Yeah, it's like you had built that foundation, not knowing exactly how you would need it down the road. Who could have predicted COVID?
No, nobody.
And I think, too, what comes to mind, you know, as you talk about how this community has rallied around you and your work, not just the book, but also those earlier essays. You know, I think if you do good work, and there's, especially I think if there's some skin in the game, you know, if you're writing from a place of deep personal emotion, deep personal risk, yeah. People who read that stuff tend to be moved by it. You know, you'd have to be pretty hard-hearted not to read somebody like really grappling with the stuff of their life in an artful way, and not at least come away with like some sense of respect. At least that's how I feel, you know. I don't think you can do much better as an artist than to go there in some way. And I can understand why you were able to find connectivity as a result of putting yourself out there like that, because I think most people who genuinely engage with it find it to be a relief to read something like that.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I and because I know that I've taken comfort in these things when I've read things and or listened to things that have been really personal. I mean, it's, you know, I remember being a teenager, like a young teenager, and listening to like Tori Amos, and that was searing. And I never heard anybody talk about those experiences in that way, and sort of the totality of those experiences and the rawness of it. And I remember, you know, sitting with like girls in my class in high school and listening to it. And I remember my friend's boyfriend, you know, he had something shitty to say about it. He was like, well, why is she always talking about these sad things? Nobody wants to hear about that. And so that's like the kind of force that you get outside, right? Like that's the type of thing that you hear. But I still remember this sort of nucleus of girls just sitting at this table. And even if we didn't entirely understand everything she was talking about, like we understood how personal it was. And ironically, because it was so personal, in some ways, it was collective, it was universal, because we could like graft our own experiences onto it. And that's sort of where I got this sense of like the importance of a personal narrative and the importance of using your own story in something. Just being a high school kid sitting at a table listening to Tori Amos or, you know, PJ Harvey. You know, music was a big influencer for me in the beginning, like Jeff Buckley. I mean, just this sort of very, very intimate style always appealed to me. And I, you know, when I started writing, I found the things that were more like personally successful to do and then sort of collectively successful to do were the things that not only like were personal, but just talked about things that people didn't want to talk about or that they might find shameful in some way, or just vulnerability on the page. And, you know, I've kind of struggled with vulnerability in real life a lot of the time, but I can find it on the page and channel it on the page. And I think that's where people are, you know, that's where people want to seem to meet me and where I want to meet other people who are making art.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think my taste is similar. You know, when somebody's being vulnerable in their work, and you know, it's also a little bit complicated because it has to be artful. You know,
mm-hmm.
just like barfing out your feelings on a page isn't necessarily it. But if you mm-hmm. do it in a way that really brings the reader into the best clarity of thought that you're able to muster, and there's a sense of narrative, then it can be really compelling and meaningful. And even if you don't have a sense of shared experience in a one-for-one way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before we get too much further into the conversation, because you're starting to touch on things that I want to talk to you about, but
sure.
I feel like it would be useful to sort of begin a conversation around your book mm. with this theme that I think it's the main theme of the book, which is how does a person who has suffered through cycles of abuse not become like their abuser?
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate?
Yes, that is exactly it. Because that is not a question that I see talked about a lot. And I really don't see it talked about a lot in terms of women and the way women process violence and process abuse. So that is exactly what I wanted to talk about. I think what it comes down to is the way that we are taught to think about power, culturally speaking, and personally speaking, right? Like we have this idea of the authoritative figure, the dominant figure, the figure that we should all aspire to as someone who is incredibly domineering, incredibly aggressive, has a lot of forceful, dynamic energy, which is also often translated into anger. And I know that I looked at my own family situation and I saw my father as being someone who seemed to, at the time, you know, when you're young and you live in fear, you look at the object, or at least I did, I looked at the sort of locus of my fear. And I thought, that is power. And if I have to be someone who does not have power and is hurt and is made vulnerable and can be damaged, or if I can be the force that generates the fear, that seems to have the force, the power that does not live under threat, then that would be the thing to aspire to, as opposed to the force that is put upon. And that's sort of a sick way of thinking, right? But I think we can see it sort of in our culture across the board when we think of figures that we're supposed to emulate, when we think about what we value. And, you know, and then personally. And so it's very interesting to me, the conversations that we've been having sort of broadly about anger and women's anger and women tapping into their anger, because I've sort of been there for a long time. And I mean, I would say for me, like, every feeling I had became anger, because I could see anger in my father as this thing that gave him power and authority, and that so dominated my own imagination and my own heart and my own way of thinking. And I wanted that, but the wires got crossed to think about strength as being rage. And I would have wrathful reactions to things. And some of the things that I had wrathful reactions to were, like, fully and wholly justified. And in some ways, like, having access to that wasn't entirely a bad thing. But the problem with me is that I would not know when to shut it off. And that's a thing that I feel like we've seen talked about in men, right? Like the angry young male figure, you know, going back, you know, mythology, that figure appears kind of constantly, you know, the great hero, the warrior, you know, the slayer of monsters and demons, you know, even in something like, you know, one of the big influences on my novel was actually like Rebel Without a Cause and Wild One, you know, and I remember growing up and watching like James Dean and Marlon Brando and, like, you know, finding them attractive and, like, wanting to be with them, but also wanting to be them because they had access to that great power.
I want to interrupt you here. I want to interrupt you just because I think this is worth, like, staying on for a moment. Yeah. What do you mean by their great power? You know, obviously they're attractive.
Yeah.
You know, heroes or whatever, anti-heroes of the silver screen. Mm-hmm. But can you define a little bit more what the power was that you saw in them that you were responding so strongly to?
So they had this menace to them, right? Brando, I think, more so than Dean, but, like, Dean's, like, getting in a knife fight in Rebel Without a Cause. And then in East of Eden, you know, he is kind of skulking around and doing some kind of naughty things that are driven out of anger. You know, he sort of ruins his brother, right? Because he's so angry. If you haven't seen that movie, spoiler alert for East of Eden. But he basically, like, ruins his brother because his brother is the golden child and he is not. And he exposes his brother to some very harsh truths. And then, like I said, in Rebel Without a Cause, he's knife fighting, he's doing the chicky run, and he's enacting these feelings of chaos and rage and displacement in ways that are sort of outwardly aggressive. And then young Brando, I mean, my God, I mean, there's the Wild One where he's literally kind of driving around as part of this motorcycle gang. And there's, you know, he has this real kind of menace, and it's a sexual menace, but it's also like a formidable violence. He's built like a bruiser. He can go in there and fuck stuff up, and there's always that potential there with him. And then, of course, in like Streetcar Named Desire, he is sort of the dark star around which that whole narrative sort of, you know, he consumes it all. And it's because he has this ability to, you know, show great tenderness, yes, but also have this explosive, propulsive violence that is also seen as exciting. Like, I think one of the more interesting lines in that movie, right, is when Blanche is sort of saying to her sister, like, this is terrible. How can you possibly be attracted to this man? Like, he's a, you know, he's a thug. He's a, you know, he's a primate. He's, you know, he's a caveman. And she talks about how on their wedding night, he went in and smashed all the lights with his slipper. And that's it. That's the image, right? Where it's someone who's capable of great destructiveness, but there's something appealing about it. And that's what I mean by that power. And I saw that sort of energy in myself because that's what I grew up around. That's what I saw. And I thought, I never, when I would see women get angry, in film, in TV or even in my own life, it would either have to be subdued or it would have to be directed towards some sort of positive cause, or they could be like an action hero in a movie or a villainess in a movie. They never just got to be fucked up and be angry and be scared and sad and not know what to do with it. And I really saw that in myself, and I wrote about it in those stark terms because I was compelled to do it. And I thought, I can't be the only one who feels like this. And then when I wrote my novel, I really did. Like, I went back and I thought about those early depictions of, like, the Dean Brando sort of archetype. And I really grafted them onto this young woman because I had never seen that and I wanted to see it.
Well, you know, I feel like the question that it brings to mind is, how does one, in a practical manner, you know, transcend an abusive situation? Like, I guess in your case, it was in, you know, your childhood home. Acknowledge, like, see all of these feelings and all of these like psychodynamics clearly, and then find a way to something better.
Yeah.
Like, do you have an answer for that after writing this book and, you know, doing self-investigation through therapy or through writing? Like, have you landed somewhere that you feel like is clear and defined on this?
That's a really good question. I think I have greater clarity, but I don't know. I think the process of writing all those essays and writing the book really, it was almost like it burned something out of me, and not like in a way like I'm burned out, that's bad, but in a way that like there was something that was raw and needed to come out, and the process of churning through it, writing about it, talking about it constantly, it does get you thinking about things unconsciously. And when I was writing the book, and I could see, like, the heroine's dilemma is so clearly, is she going to become her father? Is she not going to become her father? And I always sort of knew that I wanted to write toward a more optimistic place, not a pat happy ending, but I knew that I wanted to get her to a place where she would have some hope. And I think I sort of carried myself through that. And it's funny how, you know, for a very long time, this sort of question of my own father was the thing that drove me and animated me. And he was this sort of very central figure in my own imagination. And then in the process of like writing this, he just wasn't anymore, because I got out what I needed to get out. And now I find him in a place where, like, I have stuff to work through that's related to my childhood, and that is related to the way I grew up and the messaging I grew up with. I think I always will. But am I sort of caught up in this emotional entanglement with this man and what he was to me when I was younger? Like, not so much anymore. And that has really been cathartic for me. And I find myself wanting to think about other things in life and other forms of connection now, in a way that is sort of moving beyond this sort of immediate excavation of anger, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I heard people say conflicting things on this show in conversation over the years around this idea of catharsis through writing. Mm-hmm. And I think if you sort of like pick it apart a little bit, I will concede that you don't necessarily heal in like a super clean and neat and tidy way, mm-hmm. just because you wrote a book about some personal struggles or emotional anguish or whatever. But I do think it's cathartic in the sense that it allows you to move on, you know, and you're doing deep, if you're confronting it honestly, if you're making a good faith effort to really look at it and to go deeply into it and to try to see it for what it is. If you know, you're an honest broker about it, it's not dissimilar to therapy. It's a deep investigation, and it makes sense to me that there would be a feeling of genuine catharsis. And it makes sense to me that you would be able, in the aftermath of completing a project like this, to move forward in a fundamentally new and better way, and to have a sense of, like you say, burning away. Like the word that comes to mind is cleansing. You know, that it would have like a cleansing effect on your spirit. And I don't know, like that feels real to me. It does not feel like some sort of like airy-fairy, like woo-woo stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that, and that's a good term for it. And I, you know, I, as I've gotten older, I sort of like sometimes the way that, like, some of the best, honest to God, some of the best writing out there, and I don't even know if you would categorize it as like self-help writing, but just like writing about emotions, comes from like astrologers and tarot readers. And even if you like, I get this like email subscription from this one woman who does like a tarot reading for the month, and her thing that she sent out recently, she talked about this myth of and I'm gonna butcher it, I'm gonna paraphrase it, but it was these three young men who get locked in an ice house, and they can either sit down in the ice house or they can move. They can start dancing. And if they start dancing, it's going to take a while, but the heat and the friction of their bodies is going to melt the house down and they'll be free. And this woman's writing about this, and she goes, the things in your own life, the areas where you have not progressed and where you are afraid of progressing, that's like the ice house. And you can either sit down in the areas where you're fearful or you feel stagnant, or you can try to move through them, and it's going to feel weird. It might hurt. It might burn a little bit, but at the end of the day, you're going to see like the blue sky above you. And I was like, damn, that's perfect. Like, that was like one of like the most beautiful things I've read recently. And it came from this woman who's like a professional tarot reader. So it's, I like these sort of like big images of like cleansing, you know, burning through things. Like, I don't know. I like, to some degree, I like a little bit of woo. I think we all need a little bit of woo in our life sometimes.
I don't disagree. And I also think that, you know, if we're going to define woo as something that's like spiritual or new agey, it's really, I think what we're talking about isn't anything crazy. What we're talking about is the fundamental psychological reality that I think is clear. And what I mean is that if you're going to try to overcome a personal difficulty, like something emotional, some trauma, something, a loss, you know, anything, it could be anything, any of the big human things that plague people. What we're saying and what we're characterizing as woo is the idea that the way through is through.
Yeah.
And there is, I think, despite the fact that it seems so obvious, especially once you've been through it and you've kind of learned that it works, even though it might not be pleasant or easy, I think there's a fundamental, like reflexive aversion to this. You know, who wants to sit and take a deep look at their own pain? Who wants to do the hard work of sitting down with a therapist and going through childhood trauma or, you know, marital difficulty or whatever it is, you know? But if you don't do that, and if you just pretend it's going to go away on its own, or if you numb yourself with drugs or television or social media or whatever it is, you're going to wind up exacerbating these issues a lot of the time. They're not going to just like wither on the vine and go away. A lot of times they fester and grow worse and wind up impacting your life in negative ways that may or may not even be related, you know, in a direct way. So I don't know. That to me just seems like psychology 101, but I feel like as human beings, myself included, you know, like, you know, we can trick ourselves and feel like, oh, we'll just put it off, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think that it's sort of interesting now that we're in this sort of stasis, culturally speaking, right, where we should still be indoors. We should still have sort of a limited mobility, so to speak, in terms of where we go, what we do. The normalcy of life is disrupted in varying degrees, and certainly for some people more extreme than others. And I feel like we're at this sort of cultural moment where we have to look at everything that we've been doing to distract ourselves, to disengage from the realities that we've been living in. And it's very difficult. I think on some level, this is maybe why you see these sort of some people just really push for this return to normalcy or life as they knew it, and this sort of fear and anger around accepting the reality that we're in right now, because that's really hard. It's really hard and scary. And the way you say it, it's like, yeah, the only way through something is through it. And I find, like, on the one hand, like, yeah, that's like terrifying. Like, you can't, you know, there's no gingerbread lane that you can go down through. There's no yellow brick road. But on the other hand, there's a sort of brutal simplicity to it where it's like, okay, all you can do is just one foot in front of the other and make it through day by day by day by day. That is, like, somewhat affirming in a way, because it's like, this is the directive. This is the simple thing that we're in right now. And I know I have tried to focus on, and, like, I'm guilty of doom scrolling myself. Like, I am very guilty of, like, getting on the Twitter machine and scrolling through and feeling, like, really hopeless and feeling like things are doomed and awful and bad. And, you know, things are awful. They are bad right now. And they have been for some time. But I do find some comfort in this idea that, like, I mean, maybe comfort's not the right word, but just it's instructional to say, okay, all I can do is get through this day, go to the next one and the one beyond it. And that's all anybody can do, beyond other kind of ways that we can be proactive as citizens and, you know, as people who give a damn about others, of course, but just on sort of a molecular, basic kind of blunt level, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, as we're talking, I'm thinking to myself that people listening at home, you know, you've alluded to a difficult childhood and the stuff that you went through, but can you just, like, is it possible to just talk a little bit about, like, some of the struggles that you grew up with in a real world way? Like, you've mentioned that your father was challenging for you. I think mm-hmm. you've written about him struggling with alcohol addiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, can you just talk a little bit more about how you grew up and
yeah.
what, you know, what you have had to deal with in terms of trauma and, you know, recovery?
Yeah. So, you know, look, my father is a man who has depression, anxiety. He was not a kind man. He would have very explosive fits of temper that were really terrifying, sometimes, you know, emotionally, sometimes physically. And then it's funny, though, when I think about some of the things that he did, you know, one of the crueler things is, you know, he would get really angry at us, for instance, and he would not speak for, like, you know, he would not talk to me for like a week at a time or like 2 weeks at a time. And like my mother would go to him and be like, you should not do this. This is not good. And he would say, well, how else will she know that I'm mad at her? So, you know, there was some physical stuff. There was some emotional stuff. You know, I think of him as sort of, you know, this sort of roiling force, and you didn't know what you were going to get in terms of, were you going to get like a tranquil sea, or were you going to get the wave that just bears down on you and drowns you? So that was really hard that I, you know, dealt with in the house. I was sexually abused by a neighbor around the same time, from about age 6 to 8, I think. So that also was compounding some of the things that were going on at home. And then, you know, just like also, like, I grew up as like a, you know, chunky kid. I'm a girl of size, so I was getting bullied in the classroom too. So childhood was not an easy or fun time for me, but you know, I found like comfort in books, in certain types of media, in movies, in TV, and those things like really sustained me. They made me feel like I had a world that I could retreat to, you know. And I remember like, you know, even like silly stuff, like watching like Ninja Turtles or Care Bears or, you know, gargoyles or things with like these kind of really dense, like cartoon mythologies in a way. And I would get lost in these stories that were happening in sort of this world beyond what I was living. And that's where I kind of saw the power of that, like the power of narrative to just like lift you out of it, even if it was like a dopey cartoon, right? And I got really interested in telling stories when I was like a young girl, and that was sort of what I used to get myself out of it. And you know, things got better for me as I moved into middle school and high school and sort of beyond it, because I really just got myself into art and music and books and film, and you know, use that as sort of my emotional conduit out. Things did improve at home as I got older and sort of better able to defend myself, stand up for myself. So that did make a difference. And then, you know, just kind of finding an online writing community, finding people who were talking about some of these issues, like Dorothy Allison, Lydia Yuknovich. I mean, Lydia Yuknovich was a big one for me, and discovering Chronology of Water was like, oh my God. I mean, it was just, it was stunning. And I felt very much less alone in reading that book. And then even like reading stuff in the blogosphere where people were talking about having different types of bodies and embracing different types of bodies and moving through their own history of abuse. Like I felt as I got older, things just open up for me in terms of what I was exposed to and what I saw other people doing and making stories and narratives for themselves. And I was like, oh, this is healing. This is a healing thing that I can do too. And I could take that sort of early childhood thing where stories really matter to me and they made me feel like I could step outside of this hard world that I was living in into something better. And I think that's probably maybe how I became, like how I used some of this background that I had to become like a writer.
No, it makes, I mean, that's a very astute self-assessment, I think, at least, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of my lens on it, because I, having read you, feel like you, maybe to a degree that exceeds the norm, used different elements of pop culture to sort of map your way, you know, like the heroes of your favorite films and television shows and books, your favorite musicians. I mean, these people were real lifelines for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess they're lifelines for all of us, but maybe especially so for somebody who is dealing with all that you had to deal with as a kid. Like that makes sense to me, you know, and I mm-hmm. think it's a survival strategy, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's funny now because it's like when you think about what people are, and to some degree, like, so I did not quite hit at Harry Potter. That I missed that. I was not in that cohort, and I'm gonna J.K. Rowling of it aside because she's terrible and she said terrible things, but. People have used Harry Potter, you know, to get through this time where we are like politically right and socially right, where like that there's always these references to characters and things from that franchise. And I'll see people kind of make these comments or like read another book or like, you know, just kind of getting on people for that. And I've always kind of looked at that and went, this makes sense to me that this is where people are going. This makes sense to me that like something like Wonder Woman made such a huge impact when it came out in 2017. Have you seen the Wonder Woman, the one that came out a couple of years ago?
I did, yeah. That's the one with the Israeli actress. I'm forgetting her name.
Gal Gadot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, when you're talking about pop culture and finding comfort in pop culture, so, like, you know that scene, right? And I'm going to try to not even get emotional when I'm describing it, but, like, you know that scene where she's, like, in the trenches and, like, this village is getting, like, horribly attacked by the Germans and they've, like, enslaved the people in the village, and Chris Pine is like, well, we can't do anything, we just gotta go through, and she's like, no, we have to help the people, and he's like, Diana, they call this no man's land, and she's like, I am no man, or something like that. And there's that, like, scene where she comes out in the trenches and she's like wearing the Wonder Woman gear for the first time, and she's like deflecting the bullets on her, like, shield, and is just, like, going in and, like, deflecting all the fire. And, like, I'm getting, like, even emotional talking about it. And they have that, like, wonderful music in the background. Every woman, like, I knew wept during that scene. I wept during that scene. And it was, like, 2017. I think we were still all in shock about what the political reality was and what it meant for women. And to see a woman, a female body, get up there and do something that was uncomplicatedly brave, that was full of valor and power, and, like, you know, that to see that woman be an avatar of justice and, like, stand up for, like, little people and have such gravitas and have, like, that hero moment that you have only really seen in men, like, it hit us in a really emotional way. And so I think that, I mean, for me, pop culture has always been that lifeline. It has always been that thing that I've turned to. And I don't think I'm alone in that as someone who's had a difficult childhood and done it. But it's very interesting for me to see that sort of really resonate in this kind of cultural way.
Yeah. Well, okay. See, like, as I'm listening to you, I'm, like, evaluating my own, like, maybe more cynical take on all this, where I can be dismissive of pop culture.
Yeah.
I can be the guy who's like, ugh, superhero movies. You know, like, that can be me. I've said that before on this show.
Yeah.
But what I find compelling is Laura Bogart writing about these things.
Mm.
Like, all that you bring to pop culture and your analysis of it, like, you know, it can redeem it. It mm-hmm. can legitimize it. It can make it make sense to me at a level of depth that I wasn't previously seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're giving it meaning. Like, do you see what I'm getting at? Like,
yeah,
I think it's great that you are there to sort of serve as a translator. Like, I love a good entertainment just like anybody, mm-hmm. I think, you know, or at least I have some space in my brain for that. But I am not the enthusiast that maybe you are.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I think that the role that someone like you in your writing can perform can kind of bridge that divide.
Yeah.
You know, I think there it goes beyond just a kind of surface level review or response to pop culture. Like, OMG, that was great. Four stars. Like, you're really getting in there and elucidating, like, the emotional terrain that it's working on. And you might even be, I think, delivering deeper meaning to it than it even intended. You know, we all bring our own stuff to these things. Like,
yeah,
maybe the director of Wonder Woman was really just trying to create, like, a cool dramatic action sequence, and you're grafting onto it, like, Trump and the Women's March and the hell of our political reality. You know what I'm saying?
I totally know what you're saying. But and I think the thing that's very interesting, and you know this as a writer yourself, where it's like you cannot have any meaning attached to a certain thing that you do in a thing that you've written, right? And somebody will come to you and say, oh, did you do this, like, deliberately? And, like, if it's really good, like, I don't know about you, but I'll be like, yeah, I totally meant to do that. Like, you know, I had someone even come to me, and it was one of my beta readers for this book. And she was like, oh, Because my character at one point, she has this love interest, and it's a woman that her mother works with. And I don't want to spoil my own book, so I'm just going to be very vague, but like this beta reader was like, oh, did you do this? And I had like not done this deliberately, Brad. I was like, oh, like this just happened unconsciously, and it's great. So like whether or not like the people who wrote Wonder Woman meant to do that, I don't know. And to like, to some degree, like I don't even care. Like, but I think it's interesting that like culturally women grafted onto it and it means something. Like, I think the things that we get really preoccupied with mean something, and they sort of indicate where we could go on like a broader level. I mean, and what I mean by that is, so like, you, if you look at like sort of the years preceding current reality, who shall not be named, there was like this big trend in pop culture where everything was about anti-heroes, right? It was like Tony Soprano and Don Draper and Walter White. And it was these like really malevolent men who just like captured our imagination culturally, right? And to some degree, like you might not have thought, and admittedly, I was sort of like kind of already a little bit over that trend. But it was very interesting that we had this sort of moment in the zeitgeist where we were interested in the very bad man leading up into that election, where, you know, he would do these things and you would want to sit there and go, oh, well, he's surely done, you know, because of this and that and the other. But there was always this like level of forgiveness, and not just like forgiveness, but like intrigue about it. And I feel like, I'm not saying like the anti-hero obsession led to him, but I am saying like there's something very interesting in our culture that this is what we were thinking about leading up into that election.
Of 2016.
Yeah.
Okay. So like I'm gonna try to tie this back to your book, because
yes.
I think that one of the more resonant psychological analyses of the Trump phenomenon, if that's what you want to call it, has to do with power and abuse, mm-hmm. and accountability or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. And so when you were talking about the overarching theme of your novel, and maybe the overarching theme of your life or your young life, you know, this idea of not wanting to repeat the sins of your abusers, to not become them, to transcend. I think, and then also being honest about the temptation and the sort of natural psychological reflexive desire to become that so that you can have the power mm-hmm. that they exerted over you. That makes sense to me on a human level. And I think when it comes to Trump, like one of the more astute analyses of his appeal to a certain kind of person is that he is able to act with seeming impunity on so many levels, the sexually, racially, in terms of basic decency, in terms of fundamental issues around democracy. You know, he's a violator of every norm, and he never seems to have to pay a price for any of it in a serious way. And this has been the case for him his whole life. And there is a certain kind of person, I think, that finds emotional, is it succor? Am I using that word properly?
I think that's right, yes.
Yeah, like they find a sense of, I don't know, aspiration in it almost. Or it's kind of like he's a superhero to them that they can latch on to and cheer for, because the emotional like high that they get from watching him do that mm-hmm. makes them experience a kind of sugar high or has some mm-hmm. sort of like weird medicinal quality for them.
Mm-hmm. It's rage has an addictive quality to it. And this is the thing that my heroine in the book grapples with. Rage has, it is like a sugar hit when you get it, when you get away with something that you feel like you should not be able to get away with. And so like my heroine in the book, like she has a number of moments where she's forced into confrontations that like do require her to be very tough and aggressive and not just with her father, but with like other people. And so, but she always like carries it like one step further. And I was very deliberate in that, where it's sort of a, I wanted to do these sort of like hair splitting situations. So like, you know, there's like one example, right, where she has this, you know, she starts dating her mother's coworker, and her mother's coworker has this like next door neighbor who's like terrible to her and is like always banging the door, like just being a jackass. And my heroine gets it in her head, Angelina, that she's going to like defend this woman that she loves and like stand up for her against the neighbor. And she does. And on the one level, it's like you get this like, yeah, like good for you, like you're not gonna let him like walk all over, you know, this woman that you care about. But she goes just a little too far, and then suddenly it's no longer about this entirely, it's not entirely about this like altruistic thing that she wants to do anymore. There's like that little lizard part of her brain that's getting that hit, right, that dopamine hit, that, you know, that rush of the drug of anger. And like, that's what I wanted to explore. Like, the thing that is, anger can be incredibly satisfying because it makes you feel active. It makes you feel dynamic. It makes you feel like you're accomplishing something. You're doing something. You are winning, right? That's the thing. Like, if you can exert yourself over someone else, you are winning, and you have the power and you have the control. And I understand easily how that sort of jingoistic type of thought can have an appeal. But I think the thing that we have to do is like people, and the challenge for like my heroine in this book is she has to get to a place where like, you know, the anger that she has and her willingness to like go to bat for people is like a good thing. Like the fact that she's willing to like go to her girlfriend's neighbor and be like, you're being a jackass, like don't do this, is like a great thing. But like for her to be able to stop it there and not feel like, okay, I haven't won if I haven't pushed it further than it needed to go, like that's the challenge for her, because it's not so simple as like, I'm gonna like go to an ashram and meditate and I'm never gonna feel anger again. It's just like, how do you take anger and like make it something that's productive and that you can use? And like, I think the way like as women we're taught to think about our anger like right now is like that it has to have these like really positive ends to it, right? Like it has to be this like really galvanizing force. And that's great. It can be, and it should be, and I hope to God that it is as we, you know, move forward. But I also feel like we have to get to that place, we also have to understand like the ugliness of anger and the addictive qualities of anger and the parts of it that you can't just use in this sort of rah-rah sensibility. And that's what I wanted to do. Like, that's what I kind of think this book was like. You know, it was an excavation of anger and the power of anger and the allure of anger. But then also it's about like, well, how do you move beyond? How do you hold on to anger when you need it? But then how do you like move on from it when that's what it is called to do?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm with you on this. And I think, you know, if we're going to continue to use our present political context as like the most obvious space where, you know, people on all sides are feeling anger and are fueled by anger. Mm-hmm. I think of something that Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, like this quote has been floating around lately where she's like, you know, stand up for what you believe in, but do it in such a way that other people want to join you. Mm-hmm. That resonates with me when it comes to issues around anger that might have a political bent. Mm-hmm. Then the other thing that pops into my head is this idea that when we are angry and we are expressing that anger, what we're really saying is I'm right.
Yeah.
You're wrong and I'm right. You know, like there's been a violation of some sort, and mm-hmm. we feel justified in our anger because we feel like we're right. Mm-hmm. And I do think kind of part and parcel to that there is such a thing as righteous anger.
Yes.
If, you know, you're an African-American woman and some guy comes up to you and calls you the N-word, or, you know, I don't know, violates your space in some significant way, like, being angry in response to that feels justified and righteous. Like, I don't think that anger is necessarily all bad.
No.
And I think, like, my understanding of it lines up with something you were saying just a second ago about how to kind of transform it or acknowledge that it's there. You don't repress it. You don't try to pretend it doesn't exist. You acknowledge that you feel angry, but you don't necessarily think, speak or act from that place of white hot rage. That's the issue of control that, like, I struggle with in my own life, like, just interpersonally. I think we all have moments where we lose our temper and we wish we would have just kept our mouth shut, or just did nothing, or gone and taken a walk, or counted to 10 or whatever. But I also think of it as a writer trying to respond to, like, the present political moment. I noticed that my favorite writing about politics has a certain cool humor to it. There's an accuracy and a competence and even, like, a kind of, like, low-boiled rage. But whenever I write from this place of, like, self-righteous, white-hot anger, I always read it after the fact and just think, ugh.
Yeah, that's honestly, yeah, I think that's, because I think the thing is, it's like, the kind of purity of the emotion there, I think the thing that makes writing good writing is there something, is there nuance to it? And the things in my life, like, I didn't write about them until decades after it happened, right? And then, like, I wrote about, you know, I had, like, this sort of pseudo relationship-y long distance type thing, and it was really hurtful, and it ended poorly. And I didn't write about it for, like, 2 years, because when I tried to initially, it was like that white hot rage, and it's like, well, there's nothing interesting here. This is just, that's like when you were talking earlier about, like, the diary entry versus the, like, more measured and considered piece of writing. And then, like, I didn't write about it except, like, personally for, like, yeah, probably about, like, 2 years or so. And then, like, when I was able to sit down and, like, write about it, I was like, oh, like, okay, this hurt me. And I had this, like, raw, intense feeling around it. But, like, why did it hurt me? That's the more interesting thing. And I felt like time and distance were the only things that got me into the, like, this is why it's interest. Like, this is why it hurt me. And the why is the thing that's so interesting and relatable. So, like, yeah, I agree with you. I think, and I think also with, like, online publishing, like, the ability to, like, push things out sometimes, it's so easy to put things out there when you're in this sort of, like, emotional primacy of whether it's anger or sorrow or anything else. It's easy to just doom. It's out there. It's online. It's done. And, like, on some level that can be a good thing, but I think on other levels it might distance us from maybe the desire to sit with our feelings a little bit more before we press send, and not just on, you know, writing, but, like, even, like, social media posts and things like that. I mean, I know, like, I have had to stop reacting to things, like, as I'm feeling them on social media, like, in terms of, like, maybe Facebook or Twitter, because I had people go to me and be like, this is really intense and hard to sit with, because I would, like, have really, you know, I'd feel a lot of anger about sort of things, and I would just push it out there. And then I was like, okay, well, if I sit and, like, think about what it is I'm really feeling, maybe I can write something that's, like, a little bit more persuasive, or is more nuanced, or gives other people more to think about than just, like, fuck this. Like, even if that's ultimately what this sensation, like, boils down to, you know, I think, like, you know, the power of, like, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissents is so magnificent, because, yeah, like, a lot of them do come from this place of great anger, but it's eloquently expressed, and it's expressed in a way that, like, we'll be able to pick up and think about, you know, years from now, and maybe it'll change minds, maybe it won't, But the delicacy of the thought there is so much richer and more rewarding than something that is sort of just like bristling and immediate.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm thinking of like the peace movement.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've mentioned this before on the show, but like a logic that resonates with me is that if you want to win people to the cause of peace, you yourself have to be peaceful.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times we can see in the realm of political activism, people who are super worked up and passionate
mm-hmm.
and advocating for like justice, but they're just like full of rage, and it's hard to win people to your cause. I think that's what RBG is saying, you know, like you got to do it in such a way that you can win people to your cause, that you can build community and a real social justice movement, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is what she embodied in her dissents. And that's why I think she's such a powerful figure for so many people.
Yeah.
Because she carried herself with that grace.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's very interesting to me when, you know, when we think about our kind of current reality, a lot of what is at play here, a lot of the kind of, they talk about the swing voter is sort of the moderate person, right? They talk a lot about the people in the suburbs and what are they going to do and not do. And I would see a lot of people, you know, kind of shit posting online about the wine moms and the, you know, the resistance moms and stuff like that. Like that was sort of the cool kid thing to do, right? Make fun of the people that were very earnest in their, you know, in their resistance and very, you know, maybe it was their first time doing anything that was sort of activist-y based. And I would read that stuff and I would go, well, you know what? They're out there doing stuff and they're talking to people in their book clubs and they're talking to people and like, you know, if they do sip and wine or they're talking to their neighbors and they're getting people to do it. Like, what are you doing by being cool and ironic and detached about
right.
the situation? Or by being so heated that, you know, maybe you'll say that if somebody who doesn't agree with you exactly on this one policy thing is that they're terrible and that they don't want anybody to have good things or access to healthcare or whatever. Like, I think it's, you know, I think it's, we have to really move beyond sort of this absolutism and, you know, to sort of bring it back into writing just in general. Like, I think that is when you think about sort of the therapeutic or cathartic value of writing, when you're sitting down and whether it's like a personal essay or it's a piece of writing that is, you know, fiction, but sort of rooted in life, or I don't know. I mean, even if you look at something that might be more speculative fiction, it still might be rooted in your own experiences and your own thoughts and your own feelings. It can take you out of like the primacy of it, out of the sort of absolute of it. And you sit down and you think about sort of the granular mechanics of something. It can lead you to a more balanced and nuanced place.
Yeah, I think that there is a notable similarity between the right wing or the far right wing, I guess you might call it, like the real MAGA diehard.
Mm-hmm.
Like 30% of America, Trumpian base that is immovable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a notable similarity between that faction and the hard left in the sense of this idea of like my way or the highway. And this, I think this misapprehension of how politics in a democracy is supposed to work, like this wielding of power in such a way where you just obliterate your opponents and you get basically all things on your terms all the time. And that's the aspiration. And, you know, look, I think it's great to have ideals. I share a lot of the ideals of the far left. I consider myself a progressive.
Yeah.
But I'm going to like happily pull the lever for Joe Biden because that's what's in front of me. And, we gotta beat Trump. Like, I think you have to prioritize.
Yes.
I lose patience with people who somehow can't prioritize and seem to train all of their anger, like all of their political anger, on people who agree with them 80% of the time, rather than properly, I would argue, focusing it on people who are actively trying to dismantle democracy and establish an authoritarian white supremacist kleptocracy in our country. Like, why is this a hard calculation to make? It drives me crazy.
Thank you. Yes. And it makes, and I think the thing that sort of is hard, and I've had conversations with other friends, and I think the thing that's been sort of hard about this as a woman who also has like progressive values, I think I've been lectured a lot over the past couple of years by like a lot of men who voted for Jill Stein, and Ugh. Who, yes. And but who like would have loved Elizabeth Warren, right? And she was going to be the woman that they would have voted for, but then didn't want to vote for her when she ran because, you know, she put a semicolon on something instead of a comma, you know, that sort of difference. And so I think this time has been sort of especially draining for a lot of progressive women because we've seen sort of like, oh, we're not going to get real allyship, you know, even in you know, from people, from guys who say that they support our causes or our ideas. So I think you're right when you say that can be very alienating. Like, you know, I wonder how many people might have been turned off from venturing further into certain spaces because they feel like I'm not perfectly aligned. I don't have like, you know, immaculate politics according to like certain demographics. So I'm better off just not participating.
Yeah. I think it can be alienating for people, you know, to be like in that, you know, operating in that space between, you know, the far left and the more center, you know, the more center left or whatever, and feeling mm-hmm. like you have agreement on many things, but not on everything.
Yeah.
And yet being made out to be a villain, you know, being sort of like a, like attacked, you know, for having slightly different views or different views on certain policy issues. And I think what you're saying as well about misogyny, you know, mm-hmm. You mentioned Elizabeth Warren, like she was my candidate in the primaries.
Me too.
I really love her. And I noticed, you know, I think a lot of people noticed how once the person, like they might say, I love Elizabeth Warren, I would have voted for her in 2016 had she ran.
Mm-hmm.
But then she runs and it's like, eh, she's too school marmy. They find a reason. And
mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a similarity in that attitude to the ways in which people on the right often try to cover up their racism and their misogyny.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know, it's always like, I'm not racist. I, you know, I just happen to love this white supremacist. You know, like,
well, and it's funny. And I freelanced for Dame. I've written for Dame a lot. So I follow them. And there was one woman, and I wish I had her name in front of me, but she wrote a piece, and I hate to say this, but I think it's sort of true. And she said, I think the first woman president in this country is probably going to be a Republican, because when they pick someone, they fall in line for better or for worse, and certainly for worse. I mean, I don't even, but I'm sort of on that vein too, where I see how we tend to cannibalize our own on the more center and in the left side. So I increasingly sadly suspect that may be the case. Just seeing how Elizabeth Warren was treated in this, because, you know, she was threatened, and or Kamala Harris when she ran in sort of the early stages of her running. Amy Klobuchar, I find very interesting when we talk about rage and we talk about the idea of identifying with the abuser or identifying with the aggressor, just based on the stories that came out about the way she treated her staff. And people talk about there being a sexist double standard with that. I am inclined to disagree with that a little bit, because I don't think you should be yelling or abusive to anyone in the workplace. And I thought maybe some of the attempts to shield her from that was a little bit misplaced. The instinct was a little bit misplaced. So I might not include her with that, or, you know, or someone like Kirsten Gillibrand, who had really good progressive bona fides in some ways, also got slammed. So I don't know. I hope I'm wrong.
It's just, you know, I hear you on all of it. I think there was the Klobuchar thing with like someone's comb or their hair pick, and she was using it as a fork. So, that's where I just was like, okay, this is
like
I'm not going to vote for her just because this is disgusting.
Well, and but that's the thing, like, and that's sort of like again where it's like we have to look at like, I mean, I guess like when you talk about also when you ask me sort of how it is that I have moved beyond some of these things, like I think to some degree it's just getting older and having like more life experiences and seeing how this plays out in people who don't get healing for, you know, for like their anger issues. And like I've been in, you know, like I'm 38 now, like I've been in numerous workplaces, office environments, and I've worked under people who have not gotten their anger under control. And I've seen like how awful it is, like, you know, because when it's like when you're dealing with a parent, right, there's sort of that, you know, enmeshed quality, that like emotional enmeshed quality that feels like almost mythic. And it's really hard to like separate yourself from it. But like when you're in a workplace environment, you see it. I had a lot of like, oh shit moments, like seeing this in people that I worked with or like managers that I had, and I'd be like, oh, this is the ghost of Christmas future, like if I don't get this shit in check with my own temper and my own anger. So it's funny, like I was writing the book while I was working in a bunch of these office environments too, so maybe that influenced my thinking, you know, that just sort of came into my head.
It feels like fair game to me to be a criterion by which you would evaluate a prospective president.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just I'm thinking of Barack Obama by way of comparison, who was, you know, sort of, you know, lionized for his cool, you know, and mm-hmm. criticized for it. You know, this kind of like Spock-like, you mm-hmm. know, methodical, like science-brained approach to everything.
Yeah.
But you never heard stories of Obama like berating anyone or throwing a potted plant against the wall. Like this is a man in control of his emotions.
Yeah.
Maybe even to a fault in some sense. But I'd rather have it that way than mm-hmm. have a president who's like flying into a blind rage in critical moments and could be making very important decisions under the influence of that kind of, you know, that kind of emotional craziness. Like that seems like fair game to me.
Yeah, well, and it's just, and I guess that's the other thing too, and it's like it matters how you like this sounds very basic, but like it matters how you treat people. And I don't know about you, but like I feel like as I have gotten older, that matters more to me now than it ever did before. And maybe it's just because we live in times that feel so sort of dark and oppressive and scary. But like, you know, it's sort of interesting when you think about like the evolution of the way we've talked about. And I'm just using this like workplace things too, where before, you know, 2017, 2018, it was Me Too. And it would be these sort of big exposés about like sexual harassment or sexual violence in the workplace. And now, you know, we've moved into discussions of like racial harassment and bias in the workplace. And then one of the other things that I've been seeing come out a lot is these pieces about just people creating abusive, chaotic workplaces in general. Like there was something that came out in Hollywood Reporter about this showrunner, or like even like Ellen DeGeneres, right? Like that was a bit, I mean, come on. But they were talking more about just like just the cruelty and the terribleness and sort of the oppressiveness of being in these spaces. And I think it's very interesting that we're having these conversations now about how power dynamics manifest there. And I kind of feel like in some level, like being an adult in the workplace has really like influenced my thinking about this in a lot of other ways. And I, like I said, I can't help but think it might have trickled into the book a little bit when I was thinking about sort of power dynamics and the kind of person that I might want to be and that my heroine might want to be in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And like not to linger on politics too long, but I do want to say, because you were talking earlier about, your fear that the first woman president could be a Republican. And I think, like, let's say Biden wins, which I think in a fair fight where the votes are all counted, he should. It certainly seems to be, indicated in every single poll. But if he wins, like, he's obviously older, and it's hard to imagine him doing a second term. He might not even complete his first term, you know, just actuarially speaking. You got to be real about it. And in that case, it would probably be Kamala, who would either assume the office and then run for reelection, or who would be the favorite to be the candidate by virtue of being his vice president for the next term. And I think a lot of us have sat around thinking about, like, well, what would that look like if she's the top, if she's at the top of the ticket, and you know, a biracial woman, you know, as a candidate for president, like, are we ready, you know, and like, will the country rally? Like, I can only imagine what she's going to face based on what I saw Hillary face in 2016. I think it'll be even worse.
Well, even what she faced when she, you know, launched her campaign in 2019. I mean, it, you know, we can look at that too. But, I mean, I can't even go there. Like, I'm literally just, like, on tenterhooks, like, every day. Like, I can't even – I'm glad that, like, you can move into that space, like, emotionally and think about it. Like, I can't even – like, I feel like I'm, like, just walking around with, like, my breath held the whole time. And so, like, on some level, like, I was grateful that I had to be, like, really creative about, like, book marketing promotion, like, earlier this year, because, like, I just didn't have to think about the primary or anything up until this point. I was just like, okay, I'm going to be thinking about this. This is where I'm going to direct all this, like, anxious energy. And now it's like I'm trying to find other ways to direct it. Because, like, I don't know, man, I'm scared. Like, I think we all are.
Yeah, and you know what? It's probably, I mean, it's, I think it's, like, natural to think about it a little bit, but
yeah.
I mean, at this point, we really got to take things one day at a time and just, like, tackle what's in front of us. Like, let's get him, let's get Trump out of there first and foremost. And then we can worry about issues of possible succession or, you know, next elections. But going back to your book, I want to ask you about point of view before we part ways, because I think it's an important issue. Creatively, you know, obviously in writing in general, but in particular for the story that you're telling. And the choice that you made to make a third-person, multiple-perspective POV decision in a story that deals with abuse is inviting, I think, a certain challenge as a writer to try to have to get inside the head of not just the victim, but also the perpetrator and the enabler. You know, I think there are these kind of... what's the word I'm looking for? You know, in situations like this, there is kind of traditional dynamics that often take place in situations of domestic abuse, you know, where there's the enabling mother and the abusive dad and then the child victim. You know, I've seen this, these tropes, you know, I've seen these play out before in nonfiction and fiction alike. You chose to enter into the minds of each. Can you talk about why and how?
So that's a good, So here's the thing. Here's the deal. I think that very rarely are people born monsters. I think about, I think it is interesting and useful to understand how someone can inflict damage and violence on others. And not necessarily in the sort of true crimey podcast type of way that makes it lurid and sensationalized, but just at the kind of human level, like what happens there and what is that thought that makes it possible for somebody to do that. And, you know, to bring it back to Brando, right? Streetcar Named Desire is a really powerful and interesting and complicated film. And that is a very complex performance and an iconic performance because it is taking someone who does horrible, horrible fucking things And it distills it down to he's a child. He has this, like, you know, in his, and that's not absolving him also, which is another layer of the complexity. And Brando channeled his own father into Stanley Kowalski, and he hated his father. He hated Stanley Kowalski. And so I think that someone who's going to do an interrogation of that trope has to be someone who hates it and understands it. And so that's where I was coming from in writing the father character. And he was a challenge. That was very hard to do, to put myself in that headspace. But to my mind, I thought, you have to, if I'm going to have this heroine go on this journey, right? And you know, she's slaying the minotaur of this family lineage, right? How does that minotaur get born? And what does it look like if she doesn't do it? And so to my mind, then I had to put the father in there. I had to put his perspective in there, as hard as it was. And I think the thing is, once I kind of got his voice, you know, when I've talked, you know, at length earlier about my own sort of destructive rage and my own sort of feelings about anger that was unhealthy and ugly, this is where I put it. And maybe I burned out more of it in the writing and description of him than I did even in her. I don't know. But I just had I just was like, okay, Laura, like, every unhealthy, awful thing you've thought, here you go. Like, this is where you channel it. And I was concerned, actually, in writing it, that I was going to turn the father into, like, an anti-hero type figure and, like, inadvertently glamorize him in sort of that Tony Soprano kind of Walter White type of way. So I was, like, mindful of those things when I was writing him. But I knew that I wanted his perspective because I also wanted to get at the fact that he does, and I can't believe I'm going to say this in this way, but he does, like, love his child, or he wants to love his child, and he can't. He can't express it fully. He can't do it right. He can't take all this feeling that he has and translate it into anything but rage. And that makes him tragic. I think that is what makes people who can do those sorts of things tragic. And so I knew I had to at least try to write him as sort of, like, you know, looking at my heroine going, you in danger, girl, like, this is what you have to do to avoid. And so that's why I felt compelled to tell his side of the story.
And can I stop you for a second? Because what you're talking about, I think, a lot is the emotional difficulty, you know, of doing that work. It's not pleasant. It's not easy to go inside that mind and live there. Mm-hmm. But, like, I think another question I would ask is, like, how to do it in a way that feels true to life. How to inhabit that? Like, what kind of, like, I don't know, I guess maybe therapeutic work you've done, or just, like, lived experience of it and deep thinking that you had done over the years had given you insight into what makes such a person tick. Like, did you have to read up on the abuser and the psychology of an abuser to be able to render that character in a way that really felt lived in?
Yes, I did. I did read a lot about, like, narcissistic personality disorder. I also, like I rewatched a bunch of mafia movies too, because you have, like, in something, like, and I'm not being flip when I say that, but, like, when you look at, like, a character like the guys in Goodfellas, right? Like, they think they're right. They think they're cool. They think that what they're doing is good for their families, that they're bringing home, protecting stuff for their family, making money for the family, that they're doing things that are, if not okay, but at least morally neutral, because it serves them on their own ends. And I also knew that that's where the father's background was going to be, like, that was going to be where he came from. I think you also see that in The Sopranos, like, very much in, like, the Tony Soprano archetype, where you have this man who is acting violently and reactively from a deeply wounded place. And so I read about the psychology of it. I studied it the way it has been rendered in other instances of pop culture, where you can see And also, you know, Brando, Streetcar, where you can see the repugnance of it, but you can also see the wheels turning in the mind of the person who's doing it. And then, you know, when I thought about the way that I would write him, like just create the character on the page, right? Like on the prose level. I am someone who like loves like long sentences with like a lot of like great imagery. Well, I hope it's great, but like a lot of like imagery. And I, with the father, I was like, I can't do that because he's not going to think that way. So it has to be like more clipped, more staccato, more blunt, like, you know, it's more cursing, more sort of crude terminology for things like that. And when I sort of made that decision to do that with the language, I was able to bring in the stuff that I found just in terms of research, in terms of like other viewing that I had done as well. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it totally does. It totally does. And it feels true to form. You know, you're weaving in like the more scholarly approach with like a pop culture, you know, approach. And I can see how that would work. I think that, I mean, at least I would say I'm imagining that you did the same thing for the mother character. Like you did some psychological reading and then maybe looked at similar characters as they had been rendered. Were there pop cultural reference points that you found for that kind of character?
Yes. I listened to a lot of Lana Del Rey when I was writing that character. And because that character is someone who like, it's very interesting where like, again, like I wanted to create these two flashpoints for my character where the father is one extreme and the mother is another. Like the mother is just what happens when you just sort of go, this is life and it's not going to get any better. It could only really get worse. So just kind of float along. And one thing that I also wanted to do with the mother is someone who was an actress when she was younger. And, she wasn't doing as well as she thought she was going to do in life, and she was disappointed, and she glommed on to this very like personally powerful and charismatic man. And that, you know, like Lana Del Rey's songs are very much about like women who go toward that archetype. And then, of course, like there's the Stella Kowalskis, there's the gun balls of, you know, mafia tropes and things like that. You know, I thought a lot about like to certain performers like Marilyn Monroe that evinced that sort of very deliberate fragility and this sort of wounded femininity when I was writing The Mother. And so the mother is someone who's given up. And so she represents like another kind of pitfall for my heroine, and that adds another layer of tension, right? Where she has no real where to go. Like she's got to form her own identity, or she's either going to burn up like a supernova or just like drown in the quicksand. So it's, you know, sort of like this is what happens if you give up on your art and you give up on your life, because my heroine is a visual artist. And it really was about creating this urgency of she has to create her own path or she's going to stagnate and fall apart. And that's the end of it.
So having done all this work and all this deep thinking and made this book and made this meaning out of the difficulties that you've been through, have you noticed tangible positive differences in the way that you, I guess it, you have, the way that you relate to life? This gets back to the issue of catharsis, but I'm thinking most specifically about the ways in which you relate to your parents. And I'm thinking like, have they read your book? Did they read your work? Like what's the situation there?
I mean, there are certain family reactions that I'm going to just hold close to the vest, and that's sort of a very private thing. If that's okay.
Sure.
You know, I don't have much of a relationship with my father right now. And that is what it is. It is, you know. My mother, I'm working toward a place of reconciliation. So I think that would be sort of, yeah, that would be the way I would put that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these are tough processes and they can take a while.
Yeah, man, it's like the work of a life. And, you know, I think the thing too is that, like, it's okay if you hit, and like, this is the thing that, like, I've had people tell me, where it's like, I mean, I don't mean to always be making pop culture references, but I'm going to make another one. Have you ever seen BoJack Horseman?
A little bit, yeah. I interviewed Raphael Bob Wakesburg on this show not too long ago.
The guy who I'm going to have to go back to that one because that is like one of the best portrayals of, like, you have a difficult relationship with a parent, and in this case, it's his mother, and you try to make it work, and you just can't. And I love that, like, that show was like, you just can't sometimes, and that's okay. So, like, that's kind of where I am with my dad. Like, I just can't. Like I said, it is what it is. I have more optimism about things with my mother, so that's good. But that's the arc of a life. I think that's – people have to do what feels safe and right for them in any given moment.
I hear you. Well, I have so enjoyed talking with you. This has been illuminating and fascinating, and I'm very happy for you that you are having this publication success. It's been fun to see, and I wish you – are you working on another book? I guess I always ask people that.
I have some things that I am playing with. I also keep, like, new projects sort of close to the vest, but I am playing with some new ideas, and I am excited about.
Okay. Well, we will leave it there. Laura, great thanks for the time. Congrats again, and all the best on whatever it is you're working on.
Thank you.
Okay, there you go. That is Laura Bogart. Her debut novel is called Don't You Know I Love You, available now from DeZank Books. You can find her on the internet at laurabogart.net. She's on Twitter. Her handle on Twitter is @LDBogart, @LDBogart. The novel, again, is called Don't You Know I Love You, the debut from Laura Bogart. Go get your copy immediately. The Other People podcast is offered freely. Every single episode of this show, more than 670 episodes and counting, all are available for free. It's a listener-supported show. If you listen regularly and you like the program and you have the means, support the show. Throw a couple of bucks in the hat over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you want to write to me, my email address is letters@otherppl.com. If you want to send in a photo of where you listen and participate in the Where I Listen game, you can send in a photo. It could be a selfie. It could just be a photo of wherever you are in space, wherever you listen. We like getting photos from listeners. I like it. It's fun. You can email that to me, letters@otherppl.com. You can also DM the show on Instagram or Twitter. The Other People podcast has its own official app. That, too, is free. Go get the app wherever you get your apps. If you want to get some gear, Other People t-shirts, sweatshirt, tank top, you can do that. Just go to the show's official website, otherppl.com, click on the t-shirt in the left sidebar, and acquire some apparel. Up next on the program, I've got Anne Helen Peterson. Great conversation with her, author of Can't Even: How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. It's the official book club pick for this month. All right, stay sane. 3 weeks to go. Don't forget to vote. Register to vote. Don't forget to do that. Vote early. Please.